This 34-minute video discussion took place live on Bloomberg Quick Take on June 2, 2021. The three interviewees were risk communication experts Peter M. Sandman and Jody Lenard, and Australian epidemiologist Greg Dorr, interviewed by Kuromi Mori.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Bloomberg Quick Take's live Q&A on the coronavirus. I'm Kuromi Mori in Tokyo. Today, we're joined by three experts in the field to talk about COVID in a post-vaccinated world and what that really means. So let's bring in our guest now. Joining us from Sydney is Dr. Greg Dorr, professor and program head at Kirby Institute, University of New South Wales. We also have Dr. Jody Lenard, psychiatrist and risk communication consultant and former WHO senior pandemic influenza communications advisor. And Dr. Peter Sandman, one of the world's leading authorities on health and risk communication, both joining us from New York. Thank you all very much for your time today. And for those of you watching, please send us your questions for our experts anytime during this live stream. You can write them in the comments below and we'll try to get those answered for you. So now let's get started. Over the past year and a half, the coronavirus has claimed more than 3.5 million lives worldwide. The epicenter of the pandemic has continued to shift from China to Europe, then the US, and onto developing countries like Brazil and India. To fight the virus, the biggest vaccination campaign in history is now underway, and we're seeing some early promising results. First, I want to talk about how different parts of the world have different game plans when it comes to dealing with COVID. So, Jody, let's start with you. What would you say has made the biggest difference in the approach between COVID zero and COVID tolerant countries?
Well, besides the fact that we've endured a huge amount of deaths and morbidity and huge amounts of time being locked down, the sun is sort of coming out in the United States because we have about 85% of the elderly are vaccinated, and that's the main number, main people who are dying. And so our hospitalizations and our cases are all down to about what they were in the first week of March 2020, before New York shot up through the roof in its horrible exponential growth. It's unbelievable to have the feeling of being able to go out and take your mask off and go to dinner. It just feels just magical, and not everybody's actually ready to do that yet, even the vaccinated people. So I think it's really important to be very tolerant as people have this sort of reverse adjustment reaction to things getting better. I didn't actually expect that, but it's really happening that a lot of people are slow to let down their guard, the people who at least put up a guard in the first place. So that's what I am experiencing here.
Yeah, we've been seeing some countries that are more averse to getting vaccinated. Greg, many APAC countries like Australia have been very successful at keeping COVID cases close to zero for most of the pandemic. Do you think that low COVID risk plays a part in people's desires to get vaccinated?
You know, I think that absolutely does. I mean, you look at Australia, we've had less than 30,000 cases, less than 1,000 deaths for a country of 26 million. So it's clearly a major public health success. And I live in Sydney, you know, a large city. We had, you know, lockdown for a few weeks back in late March, early April last year. But I've led a pretty normal life, to be honest. We had a period with a few outbreaks. We put masks on for a very short period of time. But we've been able to go to cafes, restaurants, pubs, live a very normal life, really, relative to many, many other settings. But the elimination success has come with some complacency. There's no doubt about that. Mm. And some lack of urgency. So clearly our vaccine rollout is well behind compared to many other countries, including the United States. We're at about, I think, 16 or 17% of the population have had one dose of vaccine. Only a few percent have had completed vaccination schedules. There's been a recent outbreak you may be aware of in Melbourne, and I think that will really push the vaccine momentum forward, and that really needs to happen. So I'm hopeful that over the coming months, we'll really accelerate our uptake.
We just talked about COVID zero countries versus COVID tolerant. Now let's move on to how we think about COVID. As vaccination rates in COVID zero countries like Singapore, New Zealand, and Australia increase, will there be a change in the relationship people have with the coronavirus? We asked epidemiologist Jennifer Nuzzo from Johns Hopkins about this. Here's what she had to say.
I think with vaccination, we will not only bring down, and reduce to near zero hospitalizations and deaths, but we still may see, some level of circulation of the virus. But I would argue that, once we get to the point where we no longer fear serious illness from this virus, our relationship to it will change. I am worried about people not getting vaccinated and potentially being able to transmit the virus to other people who are also not yet vaccinated. And so that's why it's really important for when people are able to get vaccinated that they do so. But I think we aren't necessarily going to have a future where this virus doesn't exist.
And that was Jennifer Nuzzo there from Johns Hopkins. Peter, do you agree with what she was saying? What do you think?
The answer is I don't know. This is a technological problem because I'm using these earbuds. I didn't hear what she had to say. not sure why that is, but Jody, do you agree with what she had to say? Because I could hear you in the next room and you had the volume.
I think there's no question that the relationship with COVID is going to change. One of the issues is we've been all trying to be in it together, trying to help each other, protect each other. And there's now going to be the people who are protected and the people who are not. And I'm not, frankly, too worried about the people who are voluntarily unprotected, people who choose not to get vaccinated. I feel bad for them, but I'm not too worried about them. I'm very worried about immunocompromised people who are now going to have to work harder to protect themselves if everyone else is going around unmasked, but still susceptible. So we really need to start helping people take care of themselves more when other people are not looking out for them.
I mean, I think this is a central change that has resulted from so much vaccination in the countries that have had, the wonderful opportunity to vaccinate a large percentage of their population. Until we had vaccines, the key pandemic message, or at least one key pandemic message, was we're all in this together. And we really were all in this together. But now we're basically not. For people who are vaccinated, the pandemic for them personally is very nearly over. The societal effects are still there. Trying to come to grips with what you've lived through is still problematic. As Jody said earlier, it's people have as much trouble ratcheting down as they had ratcheting up. So it's not like everybody is over it, but it is over in many ways, at least until variants change the situation. It is genuinely over for the vaccinated, and it's genuinely not over for the unvaccinated. So the question of what do vaccinated people owe to unvaccinated people becomes a tough question, especially as we come to see the unvaccinated as mostly voluntarily unvaccinated. And I think there are very different answers to that question that are not about science at all. They're about values.
Right. Absolutely. Greg, Australians seem to feel very safe in their largely COVID-safe bubble. Is that sustainable, though, going forward?
It's definitely not sustainable. And that's clearly the foundation for some of the complacency that we see. There has been some other issues in terms of the vaccines themselves. There's a lot of bad press around the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is our dominant sort of vaccine because of the rare severe clot risk. I think we're sort of getting through that concern. I think, as I said, the recent outbreak in Melbourne has lowered the level of complacency and really provided that sort of urgency. But we've got two vaccines. We're rolling out the AstraZeneca vaccine. We're manufacturing locally, and that's why it's been a major plank of our rollout, and the Pfizer vaccine that we're getting through importation. We'll have some Moderna vaccines sort of later in the year as well. And I have always said that the first strategy should be to provide what I call disease immunity. So all these vaccines provide amazing effectiveness against severe disease and mortality from COVID-19. Whether any of us will reach a situation of herd immunity is still somewhat unknown. But I think once we get a higher proportion of the adult population vaccinated, we will provide that disease immunity, and then we'll be able to open up, so to speak. The virus will come in, there'll be some cases, there may be some people get reasonably sort of sick, but the numbers of cases with severe illness and the numbers of deaths will be very small. And then we may be in a situation where we are having to live with the virus, but it'll become more an endemic virus. It'll be lower risk in terms of, as I said, severe consequences. So I think we'll reach that point sometime late next year or early next year, late this year or early next year. Whether the government will see that as a realistic timeline, they have been talking about mid next year as a time to open up international borders. I'm hoping that it'll be a little bit sooner than that.
Yeah. I'm worried that, if I can jump in, I'm worried that the COVID zero countries are kind of like sitting ducks for COVID to come in, because most of the world is not anywhere close to immunized. And if you're satisfied keeping the borders closed forever and not letting the stranded Australians back in and keeping everybody right where they are, and Hong Kong seems very complacent to me, Singapore a little bit less so, I'm very worried that COVID zero is really COVID limbo. You're just waiting for something terrible to happen. It'll be terrible, probably on a much smaller scale than it was in the Western countries and South and Africa and South America, but it's going to come. And I really think in terms of communication, the governments need to really prepare the society for COVID coming in. And they have to, oh, I see Singapore there. They have to help their government. They have to help the people have their oh my God moments ahead of time if possible. And Peter and I call that provoking the adjustment reaction. PM Lee from Singapore frequently slips in little hints, like we think things are going to go okay unless we have another super spreader event. And then he makes that a little bit vivid so people aren't totally surprised when things go wrong. But I really think helping people have an adjustment reaction to what is likely to happen is going to help things move along faster.
Yeah, another way to look at this that I think is totally compatible with what Jody is saying is that the countries that have achieved COVID zero, they did a gamble and they won. They gambled that they'd be able to keep COVID out, and for the most part they succeeded. And more importantly, they gambled that keeping COVID out would be a short-term thing, that in a year or so, maybe longer, maybe not quite that long, there would be miraculous vaccines, and it would have been wise to keep COVID out. If there weren't terrific vaccines now, the countries that have kept COVID out would have only postponed the inevitable, and now they'd be saying, now we have to open up, and what have we gained? We know what we've lost in tourism and the ability to travel and economic damage, and we haven't gained anything. But you took a gamble that a year after the pandemic started, there would be much better solutions available, and you won the gamble. You're right. There are much better solutions available. The problem is you taught your people not to want the solutions. You know, so now you've got vaccine hesitancy in spades. Now you've got people who feel like, you know, a little COVID is unacceptable, and, you know, one blood clot in a million is unacceptable. So now, you know, having won the gamble, you have to convince people to collect their winnings. The only way they get to collect their winnings is to be willing to get vaccinated and open up
and tolerate some COVID.
And exactly.
So when you say some COVID, what is that to you? Because depending on different countries, that differs. I mean, here in Japan, we have the Olympics coming up. You know, we've been in a state of emergency in and out for months. We're so tired of it. And yet this is how the government has handled it. To you as experts, what is that level that is tolerable? Jody?
Well, I'll try to be quick because I don't want to be too much of a hog here. To me, some COVID is when all of the most vulnerable people, so let's just say for the moment, 65 and up and healthcare workers, when all of the older people and healthcare workers have had the chance to be vaccinated, I personally am willing to let it rip.
Wow.
It is more extreme than I mean it. I want everybody to be vaccinated. But when everybody who's the most vulnerable has had a chance and they have disease protection, they can protect themselves with their own actions, meaning getting vaccinated. They don't have to depend on the people around them. Countries, you know, hospitalization rates are going to plummet. Deaths are going to plummet. And the younger people, little by little, I hope they get the idea that it would really be better not to catch this. I'm really happy that older people are all vaccinated and had the choice to be vaccinated. Open up.
So maybe I'll respond to that, Kimeri. I think the United Kingdom's a really interesting sort of setting right now. If you look at their amazing vaccine rollout, I mean, the proportion of people over the age of 70 that have been vaccinated is in the very high 90% mark. And their sort of death rate from COVID's come, you know, down to incredibly low numbers. They're still getting circulation of the virus, and there's been increased transmission in some sort of areas of the UK related to one of the new variants originally from India. But the number of people hospitalized, and as I said, the number of deaths, incredibly low. So it'll be interesting to see as they vaccinate those sort of younger adult sort of groups, what control they get of the epidemic. But they've provided pretty impressive, and how I've described it as disease immunity. But it's very different in a setting that's had a huge burden like the United States and the UK. The population is, in a sense, they've been sensitized to COVID. They've been living with it for a long time. In Australia, we've been living, a pretty normal life with relatively limited sort of anxiety about that immediate sort of risk of severe illness and death. But because of that success, as I said, we've become somewhat complacent. I'm pretty optimistic that we'll accelerate in the next sort of few weeks, particularly. But whether we need to get to a situation where, you know, we're close to herd immunity, I'm not pushing that at all. I'm pushing this line of we get to disease immunity, and then we've protected the country from the severe consequences of a significant sized epidemic.
I mean, there's no question that how bad is too bad is a relative question, and it depends where you've been. And, you know, in New York, it feels to us like things are incredibly better. And if Melbourne had what New York has, Melbourne would feel like the sky has fallen in. You know, so it certainly is relative. But I think the more important point is this is a values question. And, you know, although you said we're experts, what do we think? It's not a question on which expertise is relevant. The question of how safe is safe enough is not a technical question. It's not a scientific question. It's a political question. You know, and the question how much COVID, you know, what's the right balance between the right to say no to vaccines, the amount of disease you have in your society, the extent to which you're open, the extent to which your economy is damaged, the extent to which your kids are growing up in a weird world, those all have to be balanced against each other. And the way they're balanced against each other most effectively is if the experts inform the debate, but don't try to control the debate. The government moderates the debate, but doesn't try to make the decision. And a political process, an informal political process, finds its way and sort of stutters its way toward a shared understanding of how much disease we want to tolerate in return for how much freedom.
So, Peter, I just want to go back to you for a bit there. You're a risk communications expert. You know, COVID depends on the country. How can health authorities communicate to people in the best way in a situation like the coronavirus pandemic, which we haven't seen in such a long time?
Well, I mean, it depends where you are. But, you know, in the COVID zero countries, it seems to me, you know, authorities need to communicate the incredible success that keeping it out until vaccines were ready was a wonderful achievement. And then it needs to communicate that along the way toward that success, we've acquired some bad habits. And one bad habit is to think that we can that a little bit of COVID is intolerable, and that we have to keep it entirely out. You had to keep it entirely out until you knew how to control it. You didn't know how to control it until you had vaccines. Now you know how to control it. You can have clusters without having an epidemic, thanks to vaccines. So that's changed. Another bad habit that you know we learned and we need to unlearn is that we have the luxury of postponing vaccination. Even after vaccines became available, we could wait a while. And, you know, maybe, you know, if we thought, you know, we didn't like the AstraZeneca vaccine, we could wait till we get the mRNA vaccines, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. And, you know, that was another gamble. And it looks like for a lot of countries, that one's going to work too. But along the way, at the end of the process, no country wants to be, you know, the hermit kingdom of the 21st century. No, you know, the countries want to open up. They want to have a vital economy. And for the foreseeable future, that means they're going to have more than zero COVID. And how much more than zero they're willing to tolerate in return for what kinds of freedom, what kinds of opportunity to travel, what kinds of economic benefits, that, you know, that ought to be debated. It ought not to be decided by government officials. It ought not to be decided by scientists.
And obviously, we're talking about problems that only very lucky countries have. You know, we're talking mostly problems of the developed world, and some developing countries have a lot of vaccine. But I just wanted to put that on the record. We're not talking generically for the entire planet.
I mean, Kamiri, just to address some of that in the context of Australia, is that one of the issues has been that keeping everyone safe in a zero COVID context has been very politically successful. So there's been state government elections, the incumbents have won quite easily in Western Australia in an absolute landslide on the back of keeping the community safe. There's a federal government election coming up in the first half of next year, almost certainly. And again, that's partly, I think, why the timeline for opening up has been pushed back to mid next year, because it's politically in line with the government's wish to keep the community safe. So there's this an intersection between politics and public health, which can be very problematic. And I think that has led to some lack of urgency. And as I said a couple of times, I think this Melbourne outbreak, albeit very small, for example, overnight, last 24 hours, three new cases, that's it, in terms of the outbreak in Melbourne. But it has given us, you know, some sort of context in the sense that, you know, things can still break out. We still could have quite a large epidemic if we don't sort of get the vaccine rollout accelerated quite markedly.
Right.
In communication terms, I would milk the Melbourne outbreak for all you can, all over the country. Make it as vivid as possible. Show people who are frightened about it. Show people who are anxious about it. And then, of course, you have a rock star like Brett Sutton, the chief health officer in Melbourne, who can be honest about it, who can raise alarm about it, but without, you know, scaring people too much, because, you know, people feel comfortable when he talks about scary things. Make it as vivid as possible to the rest of the country. Show the long lines of people suddenly trying to get vaccines in Melbourne, where before they weren't interested. It's a teachable moment. Of course, each one of these outbreaks in one of these countries, one of these zero COVID or COVID limbo countries, is a wonderful teachable moment. And it's not the time to reassure people. It's the time to raise their concerns. And while they're still susceptible to having their concerns raised.
I think there's a problem there. I mean, you're absolutely right that it's a teachable moment for vaccination, but it's also a teachable moment for keeping the country closed, which is not what you want to teach. So somehow you have to find a way to say, you know, this cluster in Melbourne, this outbreak in Melbourne is the reason we all need to get vaccinated. It's not the reason we all need to keep the country closed for another few years.
Yeah, look, I think that's true. I think the public health community in Australia is pretty consistent in the sense that we're way, way, way before we can completely open things up. And everyone is really pushing to try and get the vaccine rollout accelerated and advocate for that to happen. It's just then it gets to the sort of nuances of what sort of target do we need to sort of reach? How can we bring stranded Australians back into the country? Because that's an enormous sort of problem. Can we do home quarantining rather than the hotel quarantine system we've had in place for the last year? So that's where the discussion debate sort of centers at the moment. Do we need adolescents sort of vaccinated, et cetera? So I think we'll learn a lot from other countries over the next sort of few months that will really guide us, because we're not going to open up even the more sort of optimistic people on the end of the spectrum like myself. We're not going to open up before, you know, at the end of the year at the earliest.
See, Greg, I would guess you're going to have a problem somewhere down the road. You're going to have a problem of people figuring that the payoff to me as an individual for opening up isn't that great. I don't particularly want to travel. I'm not in the travel industry. I get that it's good for the economy, but I don't care that much about the economy. But for me as an individual, getting vaccinated is scary, and getting COVID is scary, and I'm delighted to be in a country where I don't have to do either one. Those are the people whose vaccine hesitancy are going to stand in your way when you want to open up.
Yeah, Larry, I think that's true, and I think there's been some crazy sort of risk-benefit analyses done. I saw one that was put out that said that a risk of significant outbreak in Australia, this was done a month or so ago, was only 1 in 100. Well, that was lunacy. The Melbourne outbreak reminds us how likely these outbreaks are to happen over the next sort of several months. So it's a wake up call. And I am very optimistic that the vaccine uptake will accelerate rapidly over the coming weeks and few months.
So let's talk a little bit more about the vaccine rollout. I think many people are looking at the different kinds of vaccines out there now. We haven't seen data from any head-to-head studies comparing the effectiveness where multiple vaccines have been used simultaneously in specific countries. mRNA vaccines made by companies like Pfizer and Moderna, Greg, you touched on this earlier, have typically been more protective, especially against variants. So, I mean, how should this inform vaccination strategies in your view, Greg?
Well, the first thing we have to sit back a bit and think, what are we trying to do with the vaccines? The first thing we're trying to do is stop people dying. Second thing we're trying to do is stop people developing severe COVID-19. And if you look at the data from all the vaccines, whether they're vector-based vaccines, whether they're subunit vaccines, whether they're mRNA platform vaccines, they're all incredibly effective at preventing severe disease and death, including within the sort of the variant of concern sort of populations. So that's why I've always been an advocate of rolling them out as quickly as possible, getting that disease immunity. And then even the effectiveness in terms of stopping transmission. So the effectiveness of someone becoming infected who's been vaccinated, and then those breakthrough cases, the infectiousness of those individuals. If you look at the data from the UK, the AstraZeneca and the Pfizer vaccine provide very similar effectiveness under those measures. Really quite impressive reduction in risk of infection and also reduction of infectiousness in those breakthrough cases. Now, that's been in the context of the predominant UK variant. Will that change with the new variants of concern that are circulating, particularly the so-called Delta variant that originated in India? Well, time will tell. We need some more data around that. But I think a strategy where we have a vaccine like AstraZeneca will need a booster with an mRNA vaccine down the road, whether it's late this year or next year, that'll be specifically designed against new variants. So I'm not concerned about that side of things. I think all the major vaccines we have are phenomenally successful at what they really want to do, which is stop people getting severely ill.
All right. We do have some questions.
I have a communications comment about some of the scenes that Bloomberg keeps putting up of all the shots going into people's arms, and mostly their faces aren't showing. And one of the things that's been very heartening to people in the United States has been the pictures of people being overjoyed with their vaccine and having selfies taken while they're getting a vaccine. And we call this the bandwagon effect. When you see other people like celebrating their vaccine, and you've just shown vaccines going into this arm and the vaccines going into the next person's arm, but you're not showing the face of the people who are, oh my God, I'm going to be protected from this. I'm not going to be a risk to my grandmom anymore. I'm going to be able to go out for dinner. It's like, I think even the way you're doing the show is an example of not celebrating the vaccine enough. I'm just like a fan of the vaccine, but so I see a communication thing and I want to change that and tweak it a little bit and put up pictures of people who are just
you want more celebration.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. I mean, absolutely. That's a fair point. And we do have some questions coming in from Twitter. I think this question kind of speaks to that. They seem very excited about international travel. So let's take a look. What are some of the best ideas for how to verify if someone has been vaccinated for COVID to facilitate a safe return of international air travel? Greg, would you have any ideas for this?
Yeah, well, in Australia, we have a national registry of COVID vaccination. So you receive a record of your completion of vaccination. So you can sort of carry that as a record. It tells you what vaccine you've had, the dates that you had your first and your second vaccine. So I imagine many countries will require that sort of record. Then different countries will do it differently. But for the foreseeable future, I imagine the next sort of year or two, that international travel will be to a significant extent, you know, based on vaccine status.
In the US, in New York State, we have this, which is my COVID New York State passport. I don't know if that's showing up very well. It's too bright on the screen, but it's on my cell phone. It's also on a piece of paper that's just as good. And it's just a state record of my vaccine. And it gets me into football games, should I want to go. It gets me a free donut at various places. A lot of places don't want these passports, but any place that can do a regular passport or a driver's license or any other kind of ID can do this as well.
Well, I do want to say, you know, vaccinations are still very new. I think there are concerns about it. So although, yes, there are many reasons to celebrate it, I think the other, on the flip side, we want to be equal and fair is that, you know, people are still worried about it. We don't know everything there is to know. So here's a second question from a Twitter. What's the latest information on whether or not someone who's vaccinated for COVID would need a booster shot? So this probably speaks to some concerns about the vaccinations, whether we're going to need that booster shot. Peter, could you speak on this?
Yeah, it's not a communication question, but my understanding is they're pretty sure that boosters are going to be needed, and they're totally unsure how soon. Whether it'll be 6 months from now or a few years from now is anybody's guess, and the experts, you know, when they're being honest, admit that they're guessing and that they really have no idea. But they'd nearly all be surprised if eventually we're not getting a booster.
All right. And Greg, we'll go to you. What's the latest info on the booster shot? What's your understanding?
So I think there's two aspects to that. One is the waning of vaccine sort of immunity. And that doesn't wane very quickly. And in fact, if there weren't new variants, I would imagine that the vaccination booster may only be required every couple of years. But given the circulating of new variants and the fact that there are vaccines that are being produced that are modified specifically to address those new variants, I think we'll all be getting a booster in 2022, irrespective of whether we got the AstraZeneca or the Pfizer or the Moderna. It's very, very likely that we'll need another vaccination next year.
All right, so we'll all have to get ready for another shot. We'll wrap it up here. Thanks so much to our three guests, Drs. Greg Doerr, Jody Lenard, and Peter Sandman for joining Bloomberg Quick Takes Q&A on the post-vaccinated world. And thank you all for watching.